Thank you very much for the introduction. So as Sebastian mentioned, I'm going to be talking about a portion of some work that I've been doing with Sumati Surya, who also does causal set quantum gravity. We have a paper up on the archive now, and it also has just recently been provisionally accepted in CQD. So I encourage you to go ahead and look online for details if you happen to be interested. So today, what I'm really going to be focusing on is three portions to this talk. First of all, what causal set theory is, why we study it, how it fits into the other approaches to quantum gravity, a little bit about the statistical physics of the system. Then I'll move on to discuss the main portion, which is the restricted sample spaces as well as the dynamics in 2D and 3D. And importantly, why we're interested in this at all is because causal set theory in general has this big problem of trying to understand how the continuum fits into this larger sample space of all partial orders. But I'll get into that in a moment. And then at the very end, I will discuss future work and sort of where this project fits into the larger picture in causal set theory. So first of all, what is a causal set? A causal set is a set of n unlabeled elements that are endowed with an irreflexive partial order relation. So these structures are partial orders, which are acyclic, transitive, and locally finite. And so what this basically means is that for any pair of elements, you can look at the Alexandrov set, the future of one and the past of another, and you will have a finite number of elements in between. And so we believe, or hypothesize, that these elements are the primitive structures of spacetime. They're like spacetime atoms, you might be able to say. And really the main hypothesis is that order plus number equals geometry. And so this means that the causal order that is encoded in the structure, as well as the number of elements, which pertains to the volume, will tell you everything that you need to know about your theory. And so something that I should mention that's very important, as opposed to other theories, quantum gravity, the discreteness scale here is fundamental. And so that means that we're not interested really in taking a continuum limit, but really this is something that is a fundamental feature of the theory and perhaps will offer predictions about what we can expect to observe at the large scale. So why should we study causal sets? Well, key concepts here are it's a minimalist approach to quantum gravity, which is very appealing. So all you have, as I mentioned, are causality and discreteness. And of course, the continuum limit, even though it's not part of the strict causal set approach, might be interesting to make connections to asymptotic safety. And so that's something that is part of ongoing work. The diffeomorphism symmetry is realized via invariance under automorphisms. This basically means that if you construct some action or any other observable, then it cannot depend on labelings of your causal set. Similarly, if you have some sort of growth model, or you want to talk about a growing spacetime, then the properties of any particular spacetime cannot depend on the order in which things are created. The topology can be recovered from the causal structure alone. There are some nice results on this from the 70s, which are now referred to as the Hawking-Malamud-McCarthy theorem. And then there are a lot of results that show that kinematic observables can be used to reconstruct the geometry for large enough scales. So you can measure things like dimension, time-like distance, even now spatial distance. Spatial homology, Mendel inversion, scalar curvature, boundary geometry. There are lots of results for this. So a really key part of causal set theory is understanding geometric reconstruction. And then finally, what I'll be focusing on today is the dynamical side of the theory. So the dynamics are determined by the measure in a discretized path integral formulation, similar to Euclidean causal dynamical triangulations. And so we see here, we take some continuum measure over our spacetimes, over our metric. And when we discretize, this is replaced with a sum over all causal sets with a measure endowed on those causal sets. So really, The key important part in understanding dynamics is understanding what we should use for this measure and what we should use for this sample space. So where is the continuum physics? Well, we have to choose a suitable measure, possibly restrict the sample space. And so the way that we do this in causal set theory currently is that we analytically continue a quantum partition function in order to obtain a statistical one. So all this means is that you take your exponential here, you analytically continue this inverse temperature parameter, go beta goes to I beta, and you end up with this statistical system over here. So this introduces an additional parameter, and it also means that we need to choose an action for the theory. Now, I want to mention here that what I've described is not quantum, it is statistical. However, this can be done in a quantum way as well by using the quantum measure and the decoherence functional. And this is an interesting subject. Lots of people are interested in working on it, but it's very difficult. And so I won't focus on it here, but I want to have you keep that in the back of your mind. So the action for the theory is going to be this Benning-Casa-Dauker action. And so this was discovered in the early 2010s, early part of this decade. And it's really a function of all primitive subsets of the causal set. And so we can see here what we're looking for are these order intervals. So you have links here, you have two chains here, you have three element intervals here, four elements here. And really what you're focusing on is for every pair of endpoints, how many are in between. So you realize here that the way they're categorized is by zero in between, one in between, two in between, three in between, and you can construct a whole sequence of these up to as large as your system is. And so the action for this theory then is going to depend on these in the form of an alternating series. In our work, we use a variant of this, which is called the smeared action, and this does use all higher order variants of this, and it also introduces a mesoscale epsilon. However, in this work, we are keeping this mesoscale fixed, so I don't want to go into too much detail about the importance of this right now. So to restrict the sample spaces, well, why do we want to do this? First of all, the action forces us to pick a dimension. So as I showed back here, I have the 2D action here and the 3D action here. And there are versions of this for all higher dimensions as well. And so when we're studying a statistical system, then we need to think about which dimension we're working in. Moreover, the sample space is super exponential. It is very, very large. And we know from order theory, combinatorics, that the ensemble is dominated by these Kleitman-Rothschild trilayered orders, as well as other crystalline orders. So there will be exponentially many of these three-layer orders in this form here. And then if you remove all of those from the entire ensemble, you'll be left with four-layer orders, which exponentially dominate, and so on and so forth. And so what we realize is that the portion of the entire ensemble which corresponds to anything like a manifold is going to be very, very small with respect to the entire ensemble. So something that we might be interested in thinking about is how big is this subspace, for instance, d-dimensional Minkowski space. So some previous work has been done on the 2D orders, and these correspond to topologically trivial 2D causal set theory. By topologically trivial, I just mean that it's endowed with the Alexandrov topology, and it's constructed from two total orders. So this is purely from order theory. And it just so happens that if you construct partial orders using this method, saying that element I precedes j, if these values ui and uj follow this relation and bi, bj follow that relation, where these are just integers in some random permutation, then you end up with structures that look like this. So in this case, the ensemble is entropically dominated by causal sets which do approximate 2D Minkowski diamond. What I want to focus on next is how do we understand what a manifold-like causal set looks like? So we have this nice ensemble of 2D orders. It's a nice way to restrict dimension. But we want to understand why that's like a continuum. So one way is to take a continuous space and simply discretize it. And we can do this via a Poisson sprinkling into a compact space-time region and use the coordinates that are assigned by the sprinkling in order to identify the time-like relations. So you can see in this image here, you might have some past point here and some future point here, which corresponds to some signal and observer, perhaps. And then because they have some non-zero overlap of their causal diamond, then you say that they are causally related. So by doing this, you can then measure all of these order intervals that I mentioned previously. And you can construct this curve of order interval abundances. And so while this is not going to be unique for a particular manifold, it was originally thought that it might be, but we now know that it's not. It is, I'm making this claim now, it is an indication of manifold likeness. And what I mean specifically by this is that anything which is not like a manifold is going to have some curve which is nothing like this. It might be some bump here, it might be something very wiggly, which I'll get into more later. But this nice, smoothly decreasing function is something which is indicative of a manifold. So something that we want to think about now in order to extend the work of the 2D orders is how do we extend this first to higher dimension, and then how do we extend it to non-trivial topology? For the 2D orders, those things were both easily satisfied just through order theory. But we cannot extend the D orders above 2 dimensions because they do not anymore correspond to something with a Lorentzian structure. So these light cones that are sort of pseudo-light cones formed by it are now cubic with square rather than circular cross sections. And you end up with something that's not at all what you want. We might also be interested in same 2 dimensions, but with non-trivial topology, and you're not able to get this as far as we know just from order theory. So we want to think about, is there another way to impose this restriction as we did for the 2D orders, but without using order theory? So we want to start with fixed geometry and topology, and then allow it to vary. And so this part right here, allowing it to vary, is still work in progress. But this is sort of the context how we're doing it. So the proposal is to first consider the latticization of a 2D flat cylinder. So you start with some Minkowski cylinder with a flat metric, and you say, I'm going to turn this into a lattice. And it has 2 parameters which describe it. The total number of sites, which can be described by the height times the width, and then the aspect ratio, height divided by the width. And so you can consider all possible combinations of these, and you have now a new ensemble to study. So we're going to consider an aspect ratio of 4, specifically so that we can ensure that we get some non-trivial topology. What this means is that you're allowed to have then points which are one really high up and one really far down. The light cones will wrap around in a way that you get some epsilon topology. Of course, if we take alpha less than 1, it'll send us back to the limit of trivial Alexandrov topology, and alpha much greater than 1 will too greatly constrain the allowed configuration. So you'll end up with something that's very tall, very skinny. So what we're looking at here then, if you unwrap this lattice on the cylinder.
Why do you say alpha less than 1 is a trivial topology?
Because you end up with something that just ends up being.
Do nothing, no one.
Yeah, think of like a very short, fat cylinder.
Yeah.
So you can't get any light cones that wrap around.
You can't get that, but the global topology is still not, it's still not contractible. It's not that.
That's right. Okay, so that statement perhaps is not as specific as it should be. But the only point that I wanted to mention here is that we choose this sort of nice intermediate regime for numerical experiments because it does allow us to have things which get max results. So it's sort of just one of these fine-tuning problems. It is interesting, however, to study what changes when you do vary alpha. So that's also something that we're looking at. So what I'm focusing on here really is this lattice, which describes your background. And then you have these red points here, which indicate your causal set elements. So what we say is that the lattice sites are either occupied or unoccupied by these causal set elements, and the coordinates of them will determine the causal relations. So it's just a simple Minkowski metric on here. So if you draw your 45 degree lines, you'll see your light cones. So really, just from the locations of these, you can determine what your causal set is going to be. So by doing so, this forms the set of MN orders when we consider N elements on M sites. And so what we're looking at here are all causal sets with N elements which are embeddable into Minkowski space. So this is going to be a superset of Minkowski causal sets. Now we can define a Markov chain by using what we call the lattice gas move. We call it this because it's sort of similar to the lattice gas model in statistical physics. So all we do is we say we're going to choose an element at random or an occupied site at random, and we move it to a randomly selected unoccupied site. Okay? By doing this, you can see in this case, it greatly changes the structure of the causal set. And so we want to think about, is this an efficient move? Now, efficient means that it's going to change your observables at every step and give you a good sampling of space. So one thing to think about immediately is that each causal set can be represented multiple times on the lattice. So of course, supposing that your filling fraction is not too high, you can just take some element and move it over a little bit. You end up with something like this, and there's really no difference. Because what we're studying in the end are the causal sets that are embedded onto this lattice, not necessarily the lattice itself. Now, this is less likely as the filling fraction increases. So what we're going to do, again, is choose some intermediate regime where it's not too sparse, it's not too full. So we say that the width is going to be equal to the number of elements, and that the total number of sites follows the number of elements. Way. And so it's parameterized by this alpha and this dimension here. So for observables, we're going to define several structural observables which we're going to measure in order to determine the efficiency of this. First of all is the action, just the Benning-Costa-Dauker action with this epsilon parameter is going to be fixed, and it will be fixed for the rest of all of the experiments. We're going to look at the ordering fraction, which is simply the number of relations divided by the total possible relations. So for a cylinder in two dimensions or three dimensions, we know that this is going to be either 0.88 or 0.815 for this particular choice of aspect ratio. And this is something that you can derive analytically. It's a fairly simple calculation to understand how this works for a cylinder in a continuum. We're also looking at the height, which is the longest future-directed path of the causal set, as well as the number of lengths, the irreducible relations. It's the first term in the action. And so in particular, we are interested in the number of lengths because we know from the work on the 2D orders that one of the phases is dominated by an abundance of lengths, as well as just from the general theory, the KR orders are ones which they maximize the lengths in some sense. So this is a really good idea for an order parameter. So if the move is efficient, a new causal set is generated at each step, and we expect the observables to change. So if the observables change, this means that the causal set has changed. The opposite is not necessarily true, but it can be true. So of course, we look at this move efficiency. We see that over the course of 100,000 steps, it changes quite drastically. If we just consider a small subset of this, just 10 steps, then we can see that it really does look like at each time, just by doing this very simple move, it is giving us a new causal set, and therefore we can say that we are efficiently sampling our space. So the other question we want to think about is, what is the dependence on the lattice? on the Stilling fraction. So for a large lattice, large M, and N much less than M, not so much that it's going to be zero, but much less than, the observables are going to be independent of this M. So this kind of makes sense. As your lattice spacing is going to zero, you're going to have something which approximately looks like you're embedding it into the continuum. So we look at all sorts of lattice sizes here, keeping the number of elements fixed. And because all of these curves roughly line up with one another, we can say that our observables are going to be independent of this lattice. And so the reason that this is important is because later on, when we choose a particular lattice size, we want to be able to say that the results that we get are, and the phase transitions that we get are not going to be dependent on this parameter. So now let's take a step back and compare to sprinklings. So a typical element of the ensemble has the same properties as a sprinkling into the continuum, as we might expect. So as I just mentioned, because it doesn't depend on this lattice spacing, you see there's a curve here, which is the interval abundance distribution for the Poisson sprinkling in black, the lattice sprinkling in red, and the beta equals zero Monte Carlo experiments in blue. So they all line up right on top of each other. So this is an indication that the ensemble is entropically dominated by things which are equivalent to the ensemble generated by a Poisson process.
Where did the red curve come from?
The red curve is what you get just by doing a sprinkling onto the lattice.
Is analytically computed, or it's also?
No, this is all three of these are done numerically.
All three of them?
Yes. Yeah. It's an average over a handful of Poisson sets, but you don't need very many to average. But the idea is to show that the ensemble is entropically dominated by these manifold-like sets. So it gives strong evidence. By restricting to a lattice, we can possibly analyze the relative sizes of these sample spaces as well using combinatorics. So this is something that I'm currently thinking about. So just quickly, I want to...
Maybe this will come up. What's the difference in motivation between the Monte Carlo and just plain lattice sprinkling?
So in the Monte Carlo case, we're going to be doing variable temperature, whereas for just a sprinkling onto the lattice, you know, we aren't able to examine that. So just to briefly describe the simulation details, what we're looking at right here for this project is 200 elements in two dimensions and 300 elements in three dimensions. And this might sound like a small number, but due to non-locality, you really have a huge amount of information packed into these causal sets. So to give you an idea for how much better this is than previous work, typically the previous work focused on about 50 to 100 elements. I'll mention in a moment what the scaling is. So for the lattices, we look at 200 by 800 or 17 by 17 by 70. And the reason for this is that for these particular numbers, you want to be able to compare systems which have the same aspect ratio and the same filling fraction. We do Monte Carlo important sampling. We generate a Markov chain from a random initial state. So for those of you who are not familiar with what that means, it means that we move a random element to a random unoccupied site using this lattice gas move. We topologically sort the causal set matrix, the adjacency matrix of this object. All this means is that we're choosing a specific labeling so that step four, is more efficient. So by doing step two, it means that this causal adjacency matrix is going to be in a symmetric form. That's all that it means. Then we calculate the action, and we do an accept or reject step based on the Metropolis condition. And then, of course, as I said, we keep epsilon fixed, measure the observables while varying beta, look for phase transitions, do all of the rest of the statistical physics.
Can you go back to, when you say it's a important sampling, is that just the name for this?
Yeah, that's just
the standard
Monte Carlo simulation, yeah. Yeah, the important sampling meaning of the measure.
I see.
So the the numerical simulations are challenging, and so the reason that this has not been done already, even at what might seem like such small sizes, are first of all, the causal matrix update is order n squared due to non-locality, so we have to reconstruct it every single time. The action calculation is even worse, it's order n cubed, even after being written in assembly, it's still very slow, because really what we're doing is n choose two updates per sweep. We have 10 to the fourth sweeps. We have a final computational complexity of order n to the fifth. So what that means is if you double the system size, if you increase double the number of elements, it will take 32 times as long to run it. So really going from 100 to 200 or 100 to 300 is somewhat of an achievement. And what it means is that if you go past 500, it's prohibitively expensive. And if you think about it, it makes sense. If you have 10 to the fourth sweeps and choose two updates per sweep, you're calculating the action every single time, then any function that you calculate billions of times, no matter how fast it is, it's going to add up, especially when it scales like n. So some other things I want to mention, we have this critical slowing down near the phase transition. This is something that's expected. There are low acceptance rates for large beta or low temperature. That's also something that's expected. And then finally, I want to mention that the code and data will be published in the future after we finish doing some further finite size scaling analysis. So now to get on to the meat and potatoes of the results, we have some nice phase diagrams or phase transitions for two dimensions here. So you can see the action, ordering fraction, the height, and the number of links all exhibit what we believe to be a first order phase transition. And I say believe because we have not fully finished the analysis, but this is sort of consistent with what we got from the 2D orders. What these phases look like, of course, you see something that looks very much like a random sprinkling on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, we see something which is new but not totally unexpected. For the 2D orders, we got things which were two-layer systems or perhaps three-layer systems. Here we have something which is very particular. It's a three-layer system, but there are always two other layers very sparsely populated on top and bottom. So it's sort of this new ensemble of crystalline causal sets. And you can sort of guess from the picture that this middle layer has the largest percentage of the elements. These two are roughly equal. These two are roughly equal. So there is some time symmetry.
What is the high temperature and which one is the?
This is the high temperature. This is beta equals zero, and this is low temperature. There is evidence to believe, based on scaling, that eventually this will turn into something which is just two layers. I want to point out that there are enough lattice sites here for it to form something, which is even a single layer, but it chooses to form this instead. And so something we're thinking about is, what role does this epsilon parameter play in this, since it does change the relative weights in the action? We want to think about what role might aspect ratio play in something like this. So there's some interesting bits there to think about. For three dimensions, we're considering sort of the same thing in 2D, but one higher dimension, so a torus across time. And we see a similar phase transition. Now, it's much less sharp here, of course, because even though I've increased n, it's still perhaps not large enough. This is sort of really on the lower end of what's acceptable. But because we, increasing it to 400 or 500 would take, years or decades to get the data, and it's just not worth it, this is what we have. So similarly, we see.
So the technical question about the,
What
you might call the integration measure or something, is it effectively weighted by the number of natural labelings, or is it one per isomorph? one for isomorphism class of causal sets. Do you see what I mean?
No. I think I understand what you mean, but could you repeat?
I mean, some ways of analyzing things, in effect, you count twice. If you have two different labelings of the same causal set, it counts twice, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Other ways of doing it, it counts only once.
In this case, it would count twice.
It would count twice.
Yeah.
But you limit yourself to these natural labels.
Yeah. So
the ones where it makes a matrix triangular. So. Okay, so.
Yeah, I'm just thinking in terms of like the lattice gas, it would be, you know, you could do some sort of sequence of moves which would end up with the same causal set, but if you had labeled the elements, they would be flipped in different spots. And in that case, we sort of just consider them.
Consider them distinct.
Okay, so in three dimensions, we basically have the same thing as we found in two dimensions. And what's more interesting, one of the most interesting parts of this, is this order interval abundance curve that we see in two dimensions and three dimensions for each of the cases. So in red, I show the hot phase, the manifold-like phase. And then in blue, I show the cold phase, which is this crystalline thing. And we see a number of features in here which we can try and interpret. So for beta less than the critical beta, we see this exponential cutoff now, which was not present before. Something that we have thought about is perhaps for non-zero beta, but still in this phase, perhaps it's sort of favoring other geometries, which are also embeddable, but are not the flat Minkowski space. So we might be interested in looking at curvature or other sorts of observables in that phase. For beta on the other side of the phase transition, there are four peaks. And of course, this corresponds to the fact that you have this layered structure, and all of the elements in each layer are related to all of the elements in the adjacent layers. So this first peak is around n divided by 4, which corresponds to the size of the second and fourth layers. So this would be, or rather, if you have endpoints, yeah, it corresponds to the size of the second and fourth layers. So if you have endpoints on either side of that, then it will give you these. The second one is just below n over 2, which is the middle layer. The third is 3/4, and then the fourth is close to n. And so when I say just below, and close to, what that means is that those ones on the very top and the very bottom are where that extra contribution is going to. But it really does beg the question, why does it favor anything with these really sparse layers on the very top and bottom? So that's not obvious.
So could it be a problem about this exponential cutoff? Does it have to do with the number of elements that you have in the causal sets? Or, I mean, if you just have causal sets with such finitely many elements?
I would imagine that if you doubled the system size and then accordingly changed the axis, it would look the same. Or it would be, maybe the shape would be a little bit different, but the features would still be exactly the same. That's my hypothesis. Yeah, if you take a look at all of these curves as you vary beta, so here I showed just two of them on top of each other, but if you look at all of them on top of each other, then it tells sort of an interesting story of how this thing moves over and then you get this sudden transition to this layered structure. So there's definitely a lot of analysis to be done with this data. As I think I mentioned in a previous slide, there's something like 15,000 simulations, each with 10,000 measurements. So it's a ton of data.
So is it true that even the red fraction curve doesn't match the continuum one?
Yeah, because of this exponential cutoff.
But if you take that away, does it match? Does it somehow look different from?
Yeah, that's a good question to plot those on top of each other. I think in that case, what we would be interested in looking at is like the really low beta
Oh, is this, this is a log log.
Yeah, this, this.
The other one log?
The other one, oh, I can go back. This is linear on both of them.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. The final thing for related to this that I want to mention is, of course, asymptotically, we expect this bilayer poset, which was something that was found for the 2D orders. Some evidence for this, which is more obvious in the 3D case, is I've ordered these occupancy curves. So for each layer, you can talk about what percent of the total causal set is in that layer or equivalently at that time. And so this x-axis here is the height then. And then you're interested in going from low beta, which is this uniform distribution where it's sort of all evenly spread out, to the crystalline phase, where you get these peaks at specific layers. By plotting them all on top of each other, it does look like a mess. However, you can also see that you go from something which has five layers here, maybe something on the end, to something which has fewer layers. And then the very light blue curves are for the very high beta. And you can see that you start to get most of the elements in just a few layers. So these that I showed here are not for the extreme cases. These are for something which is sort of just before the phase transition and just after the phase transition. So it could be the case that this ends up being two layers. So now to summarize what I've talked about, we have a dimensionally and topologically restricted partition function, which is built on this new ensemble of MN orders on the lattice. And then we also use this d-dimensional Benincasa-Dauker action. For the appropriate filling fraction, we do achieve independence on the lattice spacing. We observe what we believe to be a first-order phase transition, pending further analysis, of course. There are two phases, entropy-dominated, which is a continuum-like, and action-dominated, which is a crystalline phase, just as we saw for the 2D orders. And then we are able to identify the critical temperatures for these n, approximately around 2.3 and 1.98. There's a lot more to do, of course. The immediate next steps, do the finite size scaling analysis for this ensemble. More interestingly, variable geometry and variable topology. We're able to think about variable geometry by considering a non-uniform sampling on this space. So as I mentioned before, what we were doing is picking uniformly an occupied site and unoccupied site. But if we were to bias that sampling, it can be viewed as equivalently saying the volume in that region is larger or the volume in another region is smaller. So that's one way to get to variable geometry. In that case, we might be interested in sampling over things where Minkowski is not, but entropically dominates. So it's something to think about. Of course, variable topology, this is the entire reason that we started using a lattice to begin with, is because doing variable topology is much easier on a lattice than a continuum. If you're cutting apart and restitching the lattice, you can sort of visualize in your head what that might look like. There is room for algorithmic improvements, so we can use the replica exchange and histogram reweighting methods in order to cut down on the number of actual simulations that we need to do. However, that does not decrease the time that it takes for a single simulation. So each one of those data points took, you know, however long it took, but increasing that longer would mean that each data point would still take weeks or months or however long. So some thoughts. Moving forward, can we analytically calculate the sizes of these ensembles? Something interesting to think about, just from a sort of mathematical point of view. Is it possible to study these ensembles using growth models? So even though we can't do these Monte Carlo experiments with something much larger than 300 or 400 or 500, maybe there's another way to get to this data. And so this is something that I'm currently working on. And then are there more natural choices? The action. Again, even though we happen to be using something that is greatly favored by the community, it does not preclude the fact that there might be other interesting actions which lead to higher order phase transitions and other interesting behavior called sets. Thank you for listening.
So we have plenty of time for questions.
Sorry, I missed the beginning part of your talk. We already talked about this. Beta, what's the physical meaning of beta? Is it the coupling constant?
No, so in this case, beta is introduced as a way to get from a quantum partition function to a statistical partition function. And so in the full quantum treatment of the theory, you wouldn't have the beta. You'd have just this exponential of a times the action. You would look at the decohering histories and understand then from that what the measure is on the various fixes. But in this case, it allows us to talk about it as a statistical system. So
what's the physical meaning of a high temperature?
It's just a way of introducing order and disorder into the system. It's, if you're thinking about, you know, causal sets is very physical in that you're saying an element is a piece of space-time, but I think temperature here is not the same as temperature in any physical meaning, in a physical sense. But
well, I think you might say it's just a math. No, what I'm about to say is just a mathematical statement. You might say it's an analytically continued h-bar. I mean, it's like letting h-bar vary. But then, in lieu of a Wick rotation in a normal sense, you're analytically continuing h-bar to an imaginary number.
Oh, I see. So this
so that
it allows you to do Monte Carlo.
It's what you need to do in
yeah.
order to do Monte Carlo. It's, or it's one thing that you can do in order to make Monte Carlo possible.
So like in other theories, they might take a Euclidean version of the action doing Wick rotation. But in this case, time is not something that's that you can sort of treat as separate. The whole system is outside of space and time.
Do you use a lot of, think of this as a quasi-mix rotation? Do you rotate back again? How do you interpret the result? Is it the transition amplitude?
There's not really a rotation back. So it's the way that I see this, I think what you're asking is that this could, if once you are able to construct full quantum treatment of the system, then this could be classical limit, but not the continuum limit. So upon a sufficient coarse grain. So we do know that if you take some continuous space, discretize it with a Poisson process, then you end up with something that looks like one of these phases. And if you are saying that, well, if you go many, many scales down from this, then you're going to end up with some quantum dynamics and quantum gravity and perhaps different physics. Then the connection there is that you're saying when you coarse grain and take this classical limit, then you should end up with something that looks like this. So it's in some sense like an effective dynamics.
Can you say it has something to do with the decoherence?
Yes. So it's one of the views of quantum gravity. Or quantum mechanics, sorry, is that you can consider all possible paths through the past. So in the context of the growth model, which is, you know, if you think of space-time as something that's growing physically, then this would be like saying all possible ways that you can get to a particular causal set, all possible ways to grow it, represent those histories. And so then by looking at the action along those, you can figure out which ones decohere, and then from that, you know, there's some nuance to it, but that's the connection.
So in answer to the previous, so you made no attempt to analytically continue the results to what would amount to imaginary beta?
No.
I'm not sure. I mean, you could try to look at some observable. I'm not sure which would be the
I'm not sure
appropriate
how you
would think of it as a function of beta. You have it as a function of beta, some order parameter or whatever. I would say the dimension, but here you've built the dimension in anyway. You could take some dimension, your Meyer dimension or something. I don't know how. I mean, it's a very hard. I think it's recognized. I don't know if there's any experts in Monte Carlo, but I it's recognized as a very difficult problem to go to unweak rotate the results.
Right. That's why ultimately you'd like to actually do the quantum version, not have to worry about this.
Yes, exactly.
That's maybe a few years
out from now. But there may be some work on how to do it. So, but I mean, conceptually, you would have whatever this parameter you're looking at, you know it as a function of beta, and then, so that's on the real axis, let's say. You want it on the imaginary axis. So you just have to analytically continue that.
Right.
So you have some discrete approximation to.
Well, then probably the question would also be whether you can trust the samples that you generated with your big rotators. Weights in the first place, so probably extremely.
It would probably be a restricted version.
Yeah, I mean, as a question, is this function that you're analytically continuing actually analytic? For example, if it has phase transitions, then that's some failure of analyticity. Yeah, so there's all these deep questions, but if you grant that it is some holomorphic function, then I don't see anything. In principle, it should be possible to know its value for any complex choice of beta. To do it in practice,
that would be an interesting thing to look at.
Maybe to get a feeling for this, you can go to a very small space of 2 times. I guess points you can do everything analytically. It's just 16 points, so 16 factorial combinations. Then you can do everything analytically, I guess. Then you can see what happens if in the rotated case, and what happens in the actual non-rotated case, and then maybe make a statement there.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Of course, you know, the number of combinations does increase. Very large.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, at least to get a feeling. I mean, if it doesn't work for this small space, then maybe it also doesn't work for the larger space.
Yeah, this is something we're thinking about in relation to enumeration states.
You plot the 3 layers. So what's the vertical axis?
Time. For the, when I showed the layers? Yeah, so it's space versus time.
Oh, so these points are your configuration for space time.
Yes. So this is the embedding onto this lattice, which is the discretization of the Gaussian cylinder.
Really? You must plot the actual causal set. Is that right? What atypical?
Let's go back.
Oh, not that.
These ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in this case, x and y versus time, and in this case, space versus time.
Isn't this weird that you have this later?
There's a lot of weird things about this, yeah. 100%, I agree. Why is it centered the way it is? There's no reason it should be. I mean, perhaps that's something to do with these guys on the end. If those weren't there, I mean, why is it still centered? Why is it not shifted up or down? That's weird. So I mean, even though this phase is the one we're really interested in for continuum physics, since the other phase is sort of like the ground state of the model, it's also interesting to try and understand what are all of the features. And there's really a lot to look at, partly because there's a lot of data, but partly because there's just a lot of features here. You know, if you go to these curves, then you might be interested in thinking about how do those peaks get sharper or broader when you change the system size. You know, is it really forcing things into all of these layers? What's the spacing between those layers? Is it essential that everything in one layer is related to everything in the next layer? There's some open questions.
Maybe just go back on the slides to the other plot of your typical. So the right hand side is dominated by the action.
That's That's
left
right.
Hand side is dominated by basically entropy because you have many more states that are being possible to be occupied. So isn't that somewhat counterintuitive that your phase is dominated by your action? Like it's supposed to be a discretization of the Einstein-Hilbert action. It gives you a non-manifold like concept.
Yeah, so it is a bit counterintuitive. I agree with that. But the idea sort of is that you start with this ground state, which is your crystalline layered thing. And this is what you have at the beginning of time or at the beginning of the universe. And then it evolves from this state into. So it's, even though you could say that this is like low temperature and high temperature, and well, maybe it doesn't make sense to go from low temperature to high temperature, because this temperature isn't physical to begin with, it's not really temperature in the sense of cosmology and Big Bang and everything. I would say the way to interpret it is that you start with some ground state, which then evolves into some higher energy state.
Yeah, and you also have to take into account that in the kinematic level, you've already built in that it is a manifold.
That's right.
So that if you do a random, the most entropically favored things will look like a manifold.
That's actually a very important part, yeah. Because with the 2D orders as well, those are it's the same sort. And the thing is, we have sort of chosen these so that we get the manifold out. I mean, in the 2D order case, it was a bit of luck. But yeah, it's in the other comment I wanted to make is that if you consider the entire ensemble, of course, then the KR orders entropically dominate, which are nothing like manifolds. So really, we're saying take away a huge portion of the sample space so that the portion which remains is entropically dominated by the thing we want to set. So that's perhaps one way to look at it. Any other questions?
Go ahead. So how convinced are you that this is the first order transition, not the second one?
I am not ready to put any of my reputation behind that statement. The answer is we believe it to be first order. One of the reasons is that we see coexistence of phases when we're looking at the observables at the points near the phase transition. It, of course, requires further study. Perhaps larger N would be nice, but maybe not necessary. But that's sort of the very next thing on the roadmap here, is to do that rigorous analysis, and then I can come back and make a claim about it.
You said something about looking at topology, dynamical topology, I guess you.
That's right.
How would you do that?
Yeah, that's
even a rectangular lattice.
That's a very interesting and a very difficult point that Simonti and I have talked about a lot. And the general idea is that you use the lattice as a way to do this. So take all of the elements off for a moment and just say you have the cylindrical lattice, and then you can sort of unzip it in two spots and rezip the other spots, so it goes from one cylinder to two cylinders back to one cylinder. So the constraints there are the initial and final times are S1 topology. Everything in between, you can have anything. Of course, this is very difficult because determining the causal structure becomes a challenge. But the idea is so long as your lattice has room for it, it moves a lot.
Are you making the lattice itself dynamical now?
Yes.
You need an action for it, or no, you just use the regular. I mean, well, you're putting in an effective weight, an effective sampling bias,
right?
Depending on how you.
These are still points that we're trying to think about, but I think the general gist of it is the zipping and unzipping of the lattice, and then if you have a large enough lattice. If it's not filled up too much with causal set elements, then you should be able to get some dynamical topology change such that the endpoints are a good thing.
The other thing you threw out was maybe there's another action Do you have some ideas?
Well, there's plenty of ideas. You could choose a link action, you could choose a relational action, you could choose an action where all of the coefficients are different from what they are currently. I'm not claiming that any of those will give the continuum, this continuum phase.
So it's just the idea is sort of explore the space of action.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not that there's some specific physical consideration that leads you to a
there
different
might be.
Action.
There might
or
be.
Or is that?
I promise I'm not hiding anything there. But it's something that, in particular, Astrid has been interested in about as we look at perhaps the continuum on that of causal set theory. Try and understand if there are any interesting relations, if you can interpret things one way or another. And of course, the other part of it is the action that we use here is Benincasa-Dauker action. Isn't determined by microscopic first principles. It's sort of reverse engineered because we know what we want in the end. We know it should be GR. But for me, it would be much more satisfying if you come up with some model of quantum gravity where those coefficients pop out naturally. So that's one reason why I would say maybe we should.
Yeah, Astrid is playing with some such ideas that.
Yeah, Astrid and Sumati and some others are interested in.
So your action don't come from particular quantum gravity theory, right?
It doesn't what?
It doesn't come from particular quantum gravity theory. It's more like...
It comes from this quantum gravity.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. But the idea is that the action that we use is chosen so that at large enough sizes, it will match the Einstein-Hilbert action. So it's reverse engineered in that sense, which is not bad. It's very good. But we shouldn't be limited by this.
Any more action questions? I don't see any, so let's thank William again. He will be here for roughly 2 more years. So yeah, ask any more questions. Let's thank him.